The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Okay, if I could, I'd like to start the next session. Great. My name is Harvey Ryshikoff. I'm from the National War College. I'm currently the chair of the National Security Strategy Department at the National Defense University. And at first I'd like to begin, which I know the panelists will do, is to thank the law school. I want to thank the law school for two things. First, having a National Security Law Student Society, and particularly to Kelly McClanahan and Josh Dermott and to Brad Moss, because they have been the moving forces, and I've known them for a number of years. And the school is doing two things which is quite critical. The first thing the school is doing, it's raising the bar for public debate on national security issues. And I think it's very important that these issues are debated in open forums such as this, and it's a hallmark of what makes America and our particular democracy so envied around the world. But we have to do more of these type of open forum discussions on these issues. And the second aspect of the forum, which is particularly compelling to me, is its comparative perspective. Too often we have conversations that are quite singular in the United States, and we don't look to other countries' experiences to get a sense and perspective of how we should do things. And for those two very functions, I think the Dean, Claudio Grossman, and this National Security Law Society should particularly commend them. And I'd like to begin with a round of applause for all the work they've done already in doing this. I will now move to our extraordinary panel, which follows in tradition of the previous panel. We have amassed a real group of expertise. The first speaker will be Keith Weston, and for the viewing audience, I will just briefly say who they are, their backgrounds. He's currently a senior research fellow in counterterrorism at the Cranfield University Resilience Center in the Defense Academy of the United Kingdom. He was a career counter-terrorist officer and served in both the special branch and the anti-terrorist branch. In 2003, he was awarded the Queen's Police Medal, and he retired in 2005 after 32 years with the Metropolitan Police Service. He's also a graduate of Exeter University, and we'll be using the colonial courtesy rule, which means we'll allow him to go first. He then will be followed by Kate Martin, and she has been director at the Center for National Security Studies since 1992. Where she has litigated and written about national security and civil liberty issues, including government secrecy, intelligence, terrorism, and enemy combatant detentions. She's also taught at the Strategic Intelligence Public Policy Institute at George Washington, Georgetown University School of Law, and has served as the General Counsel of the National Security Archive. She's a graduate of the University of Virginia Law School and Pomona. Our last speaker is Vicki Duvall. Currently participates in a weekly seminar at the Naval Academy on Just War Tradition, and is researching and writing articles on issues relating to the assassination of terrorists. Previously, she was Minority Counsel and later General Counsel to the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, what we know as CISI, where she contributed to the drafting of Title IX of the U.S. Patriot Act of 2001. She's also served as the Deputy Legal Advisor to the Counterterrorist Center of the CIA, and she has worked extensively on legal issues affecting counterterrorism and operations. As you can see from their backgrounds, it's very hard to think of a better group to deal with this issue. And the issue is, which is a tension that has existed for a number of years, is this notion of, do we need something akin to MI5, or a domestic intelligence service, to replace the current structure we have where the lead agency is the Federal Bureau of Investigation? And the reason we thought it'd be an intriguing and important panel is because in the event of another event taking place in the United States, there will be the traditional process in our country of who do we pin the tail on for this particular event. Will it be Homeland Security? Will it be CIA? Will it be FBI? Will it be CIA? And what will be the traditional response to having restructuring? We've already done this once with the creation of the DNI, and with the role of the DNI in relation to domestic intelligence is another major question. So without further ado, I will turn it over to our British colleague for his views and sense of MI5.
Thank you, Harvey. And again, I'd like to add my thanks to Kelly, Josh and Brad for giving me the opportunity to come over and speak to you this morning. I intend to start with a quotation from this side of the Atlantic, then end with one from my side of the Atlantic. So the first, proponents of a US version of the British MI5 for domestic intelligence gathering often idealise the concept whilst ignoring the reality and the significant cultural differences between our two countries. That was a quote from Richard Burr from your House of Representatives in February 2004. This morning I intend to cover the following areas: the UK counter-terrorist structure, very briefly, the challenge of counter-terrorism, the dangers, and finally end up with a few words about the FBI. These are my thoughts. They're not attributed to either my former employers at New Scotland Yard and definitely not to my current employers at Cranfield University. So the UK CT structure. The Security Service, or known as MI5, originally formed in 1909 as one part of the Secret Service Bureau. It was formed in response to the perceived threat from German military spies inside the United Kingdom. The Security Service is now the lead intelligence agency in the UK for dealing with the threat from international terrorism. The Secret Intelligence Service, MI6 or SIS, is the other part of the Secret Service Bureau that eventually became the Secret Intelligence Service. This organisation has responsibility to gather intelligence overseas to protect UK interests. The Government Communications Headquarters, GCHQ, formed at the end of World War II from the codebreakers of Bletchley Park and deals with signals intelligence. Special Branch. The first Special Branch was the Metropolitan Police Special Branch, formed in 1883 to counter the threat from Fenians, the forerunners of the IRA. Until 1989, the Security Service was a secret organisation and had a very small London-based staff. MI5 needed staff to undertake investigative inquiries and looked to the UK Police Service to undertake these investigations. This led to the creation of special branches in each of the UK police forces. Special branch officers are all serving police officers. They work in plain clothes and are recruited from the uniform or CID branches. They remain under the control and direction of their individual chief constables. There is no national special branch. Special branch officers are all vetted to handle secret intelligence, and some are vetted to handle top secret and above intelligence. They receive additional training in national security and counter-terrorism investigations. Historically, Metropolitan Police Special Branch had the lead responsibility in Great Britain for the intelligence collection regarding Irish Republican terrorist threat. In 1992, this responsibility was given to the Security Service. A national coordinator for Special Branch was appointed in 2003. The Anti-Terrorist Branch. In 1972, after a series of anarchist bombs in London, it was apparent that a specialist unit was needed to deal with such incidents. Metropolitan Police Special Branch had neither the skills nor expertise to respond to such incidents. The bomb squad was created and staffed by officers from the CID and Special Branch. This squad grew into the Anti-Terrorist Branch and went on to deal with the IRA and international terrorist attacks over the next 30 plus years. Today, the Anti-Terrorist Branch is a model of professionalism, expertise and experience in dealing with a current terrorist threat. Their mission is to detect terrorists before they can attack. If they are unable to detect and prosecute the terrorists, they will attempt to disrupt their activities, and if they cannot disrupt them, they will seek to deter terrorists through high visibility overt policing activities and the creation of a hostile environment for terrorists. To achieve this mission, the Anti-Terrorist Branch, under the direction of the National Coordinator of Terrorist Investigations, works closely with the Security Service, Metropolitan Police Special Branch, and special branches across the United Kingdom, with a wider police service, other emergency services, and with a diverse community in the UK. New Scotland Yard. Some people mistakenly believe that New Scotland Yard is a national police force like the FBI. They're wrong. It is, in fact, the name of the building that houses the headquarters of the Metropolitan Police Service. The Joint Terrorism Analysis Centre. JTAC was created in June 2003 and is the UK's Centre of Excellence for Terrorist Threat Assessment. It is a multi-agency unit responsible for analysing all source intelligence on the activities, intentions and capabilities of international terrorists who may threaten UK and allied interests worldwide. JTAC is driven by customer demand and produces high-quality, relevant reports for wide distribution and a variety of security classifications. Of particular note is the production of reports for the wider police service at the lowest possible classification, whilst making them timely and relevant to the reader without compromising sensitive techniques or sources. JTAC is staffed by personnel from a number of departments and organisations, including MI5, MI6, GCHQ, Home Office, Foreign and Commonwealth Office, Department of Health, Ministry of Defence, the military and the police. What is the challenge of counter-terrorism? The primary role of those engaged in counter-terrorism is to prevent the act. Counter-terrorism legislation is different to ordinary criminal legislation in that there are many offences that are intended to provide law enforcement agencies with additional powers that are not available when dealing with ordinary decent crime. The challenge today is to prevent young men and sometimes women from being motivated by a perverted ideology that compels them to commit mass murder during multiple simultaneous attacks whilst killing themselves in the process. Counter-terrorist agencies need a legislative framework, professional, dedicated staff who are well-trained and are provided with the best equipment to enable them to carry out their task. The danger. A strong internal intelligence agency that has the mission to protect its citizens from danger, whether terrorism, espionage, subversion, or threat to the economic well-being of the nation, is only a danger to society when it works for a repressive regime. In a liberal democracy such as the United States of America, the United Kingdom and others, where there's a democratically elected government, where there is transparent oversight, where there are checks and balances, where there is the rule of law, a strong internal intelligence agency will not be a threat to human rights. It will act as a defender of those rights on behalf of its citizens. A strong internal intelligence agency will create a hostile environment for the terrorists and a safe environment for the citizens. There needs to be an acceptance that we live in a dangerous world. That is not to say that we should be in a continuous state of fear. I'm not saying that living in a liberal democracy gives the state the authority to implement increasingly draconian measures against its citizens. Such measures will only increase fear, create mistrust and hostility between communities, thereby leading to providing a fertile breeding ground for future terrorists. We need to accept the limitations of living in a liberal democracy. We need to accept that despite the best efforts of intelligence and law enforcement agencies, terrorists will at times succeed. We need to be prepared for the consequences of terrorist attacks and to seek to limit the damage terrorists seek to inflict. Put bluntly, it is realistic to intend to achieve a reduction and containment of the threat posed by the terrorist. It is not realistic to attempt to eradicate the threat. Turning to the FBI. The FBI has a long and proud tradition of protecting the citizens of the United States from serious and organized crime, from spies and from terrorists. This is not to say that the FBI is perfect. I don't think any organization can say it was perfect. Indeed, the underlying principle of the anti-terrorist branch is continuous improvement. The FBI was historically a reactive, not a proactive organization. For reasons that go back to the origins of the United States Constitution, controls were placed on the FBI regarding what it could and could not do and what information it could access. Since 9/11, the US government has deemed it necessary to give the FBI more freedom to conduct investigations. The FBI has undergone an internal restructuring and has created the National Security Branch. Intelligence officers are not created overnight, and there is a difference between an intelligence officer and a law enforcement officer. The main difference is one of culture. Historically, intelligence officers were Cold War warriors. They have operated against professionally trained foreign intelligence agents in a long game environment. Today's threat is predominantly from young men who are prepared to die to achieve their purpose of committing mass murder of innocent members of the public. Some, not all, have attended training camps. Some are motivated by what they see on the television or internet. And the experience from Europe suggests that they are from within our own communities. The FBI has the staff, the expertise, the international intelligence and law enforcement linkages to be an effective and efficient counterterrorism agency. They have the tools in the form of legislation, surveillance capability, and domestic law enforcement liaison through the Joint Terrorism Task Forces, or JTTFs, to investigate perceived terrorist threats. The FBI is an evolving organization. All organizations need to evolve to survive. But to survive in challenging times, the evolution needs to be rapid, but not that rapid that it becomes a revolution. One revolution in any country's history is enough. The FBI cannot change overnight. Staff, particularly senior staff, are leaving. Training needs to be developed. The organization needs to grow, and equipment needs to be kept up to date. Nevertheless, there does appear to be a gap. The gap is in perception. The United States appears to perceive counterterrorism as a national security matter, and therefore a federal issue. This means that state, local, and tribal law enforcement and emergency management agencies are not considered as counter-terrorist partners or even as customers. There appears to be an intelligence community that also does counter-terrorism. Until the US government and the people of the United States recognize that countering terrorism is the responsibility of everyone, then terrorists will continue to exploit the weaknesses in the system and undertake successful attacks. One of the functions of the FBI is to collect, assess, disseminate, and act upon information to protect the citizens of the United States from terrorist attacks. JTTFs are the regional offices set up by the FBI to work with local law enforcement agencies to follow up the intelligence leads. At face value, this would appear to be the ideal system. Unfortunately, not all US law enforcement agencies are members of JTTFs. Also, there does not appear to be an all-inclusive preventative strategy, either from the FBI or the Department of Homeland Security. A preventative strategy would include federal, state, local, and tribal law enforcement having access to relevant information based on an assessment of current intelligence. One way of overcoming this deficit would be to place representatives from state, local, and tribal law enforcement agencies into NCTC or DHS, mirroring the example of JTAC in the United Kingdom. The embedded law enforcement officers would be the subject of security vetting and have access to raw intelligence. They would be able to discuss with their colleagues from the intelligence community how to issue low classification intelligence reports to all levels of the law enforcement and emergency management community. These reports will be written in a way that does not compromise secret or sensitive sources or techniques and will concentrate on terrorist weaponry, tactics, methodology, training, fundraising, etc. Such information would allow state, local, tribal law enforcement and other emergency responders to better understand the threat, to identify opportunities to recognize and react to possible terrorist pre-attack activity, such as procurement, training, hostile reconnaissance, and to prepare an effective multi-agency response should an attack occur. For a more detailed analysis of this discussion, I refer you to Beyond Connecting the Dots, an investigative report prepared for Congressman Benny G. Thompson, the U.S. House Committee on Homeland Security, and it is on the web. My closing comment is a quote from the Director General of the Security Service, Dame Eliza Manningham Bullock, and is taken from a speech she made in September 2005, in which she referred to the terrorist attacks in London in July 2005. Those of us in the intelligence community are also aware of many more attacks thwarted by good intelligence and police work and through international cooperation. These successes have usually been the quiet ones. But we are judged by what we do not know and did not prevent. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Keith.
Good morning. I also want to thank the law school and especially the student organizers for putting together this conference. I've been working on national security issues and the law for many more years than I care to count. And it what used to be an area in which Vicki and I worked on it and a few other people and hardly anybody else, and it's now obviously an area that is of interest to many more people, and I think it's an area of the law that is both difficult and completely fascinating in that it demands both a kind of deep understanding of constitutional principles and at the same time a lot of understanding of operational necessities in the intelligence world. So today, this morning, I want to lay out the case about why I believe the counterterrorism in the United States needs to be linked to a law, to the task of law enforcement, and whether or not that's done through an agency by the FBI, like the FBI, or some other agency housed in the Justice Department, that it is essential that we don't give the task of counterterrorism to a, quote, intelligence agency that's not part of and intrinsically linked to a law enforcement agency. And I want to start with a report that was in U.S. News and World Report this week about a conversation that took place evidently shortly after 9/11 with some administration-appointed lawyers. And according to the magazine, the FBI director and some career lawyers from the FBI, in which the administration appointees argued that the president should have the power to authorize warrantless physical searches of Americans' homes. And as you all know, they did in fact authorize warrantless wiretapping of Americans, but the magazine reports that there was a discussion of going further and authorizing warrantless searches, so-called black bag jobs, and the FBI director vigorously objected. And I think that that story illustrates the problem that we face when you argue that you should have solely an intelligence agency in our country. As most of you probably know, physical searches for national security purposes are allowed under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act and are allowed to be carried out and kept secret forever. The difference is that they're subjected to some degree of judicial oversight, and the proposal evidently was to allow such physical searches to be carried out by intelligence agencies without any judicial oversight. I just want to also mention a couple of what I believe to be myths that have come to be, quote, accepted wisdom in Washington that are relevant to this discussion. The first one is that the FBI was not in the business of prevention of terrorist attacks before 9/11. That is completely untrue. One of the FBI's major successes before 9/11 was that they prevented an attack that was being planned in New York City on the Holland Tunnel. They did it using a combination of intelligence authorities and undercover informant and traditional law enforcement, and prevented the attack by indicting the conspirators and putting them away for life. The way the FBI was organized before 9/11 was that it had a law enforcement side and a domestic intelligence side. And one of the things I think that's frequently overlooked in this conversation about do we need a domestic MI5 is the question of what do we mean by a domestic intelligence agency. If you look at an intelligence agency as having at a minimum two primary tasks, the collection of information and the analysis of information, that those two tasks, of course, belong to law enforcement agencies as well. And they may be different in the case of a bank robbery, and that may not be at all analogous to the question of investigating and preventing counterterrorism, but it is certainly at the task of intelligence, as we generally understand it, is certainly something that law enforcement is used to in the context of investigating complicated mafia or drug conspiracies, where they look for patterns, they look for connections, et cetera. The difference, I think, is that intelligence agencies aren't given the authority to arrest or to participate in prosecutions. And this is an important difference in talking about what kind of agency makes sense for the United States, because I think it goes to the question of what do we expect an intelligence agency, or put it more broadly, what is the task of a counterterrorism agency inside the United States? One of the traditional tasks of the CIA and of intelligence agencies in general has been to collect information for use by the policymakers in determining, for example, what makes sense with regard to Iran's nuclear plans. The task of a counterterrorism agency, especially inside the United States, I would submit is quite different, which is to understand, to first identify the potential sources of attacks, whether or not they be individuals who are overseas and would seek to come here or individuals who are already in the United States, to locate those individuals and to, quote, disable or disrupt those individuals. But of course, the key difference when you're talking about operating inside the US and operating overseas is what means the government can use to disable or disrupt planned terrorist attacks. And I think we would we certainly are used to agreed, and I don't know, maybe there's now dissent on this issue, but certainly that the Constitution and the Bill of Rights require that the means that the government uses to prevent terrorist attacks in the United States have to be consistent with the Bill of Rights, which would be namely arrest. If you can't arrest somebody, perhaps you can deport them. If you can't deport them, you can keep them under surveillance until you can arrest them or deport them, or perhaps you can turn them into an informant. There are certain means that are available to intelligence agencies overseas that are not available because of constitutional limitations to the intelligence agencies inside the United States, and namely targeted killings, kidnappings off the street, et cetera. I think the other important difference, besides looking at the different tasks of a traditional overseas intelligence agency and a domestic counterterrorism agency, has to do with questions of oversight. And I think we can identify three or four key differences between, let's take on the one hand, the CIA operating overseas and the FBI or some other domestic intelligence agency operating in the United States. The first one is that there's much greater level of secrecy with regard to the CIA's operations abroad, and that is, of course, by necessity. The second one, which is related to that, is that there is much less oversight of the activities of a, quote, intelligence agency than there is, than exists in terms of oversight of the activities of a law enforcement agency. And most prominently, law enforcement agencies or domestic counterterrorism agencies, which have one eye on eventual prosecution, have to keep in mind that sooner or later the case and the evidence and the means that were used to gather the evidence will be put before a court. And they want that evidence to be usable, and they want that evidence to be effective against the defendant. No such check exists with regard to the CIA's activities, which are never reviewed by a court. At the same time, and you can see this historically, there's much more public accountability for domestic FBI activities in terms of public reporting to the Congress and to the, than there is about the CIA's activities. There's much greater congressional, and I would submit greater, more effective congressional oversight. You can see that in the various controversies that have arisen since 9/11 over what Congress did and didn't do with regard to the CIA's mistakes, et cetera, on WMD in Iraq. But there's one other key difference, and that is, I think, that one of the key reasons why a country needs an overseas intelligence agency is that they need the capability to send an agency to break the law overseas when necessary, and to use force, in fact, when necessary. And that the basic principle has to be within the United States that the government agencies are bound by the domestic laws. And sometimes when I say this, I'm greeted with outrage by members of the CIA in the audience who say, of course we abide by the law. And I want to be clear is that I'm not making that the point that the CIA breaks U.S. laws. I'm making the point that the CIA exists to go abroad and break the laws of the country in which it's operating, and that that is a necessary function and an important function. But the question then, whether or not you want to bring an agency that has that kind of capability and understanding back home, I think, is a very serious problem. And I then want to make one more comparison, which I think goes to not the, so much to the risks to constitutional government or the risks to civil liberties if you bring the methods and approach of an intelligence agency inside the United States, but goes to the question of effective counterterrorism. And I think that it's an issue that is simmering, is not talked about in Washington as much as it needs to be, but will end up being the key issue, which is the following, that an intelligence agency views its fundamental task as the collection of as much information as possible. They don't like to discard information because the theory is that you can never tell when the information might turn out to be useful, even though it's not useful right now. That a domestic counterterrorism agency that's trained in law enforcement as well as intelligence analysis and who understands that their ultimate task is to be able to bring a prosecution and convict an individual looks at information quite differently. And they look at the information in terms of, does this information really make a case about this particular individual? And it's not that they necessarily need to meet the beyond a reasonable doubt standard, but it requires a kind of discipline in looking at information, which when you're talking about the liberty of individuals, I think is very important. It's also very important when you're trying to identify which individuals, in fact, really are involved in planning the next terrorist attack. Just a couple of words about where we are today. As has been mentioned, and as you know, the Intelligence Reform Act passed in late 2004 changed the intelligence structure, and I'm not sure whether or not it did it in any intelligible way, but it tried to break down the barriers between overseas intelligence and domestic intelligence. It set up the National Counterterrorism Center, which was meant to be a place where, quote, all source intelligence information is shared, both from overseas and domestically. It put the Director of National Intelligence in charge of all counterterrorism efforts, both overseas and here. There has still been criticism of the competency of the FBI to carry out this task. That seems to me a separate question, and the question of what kind of authorities should a domestic counterterrorism agency have. But I do want to flag, and perhaps in the question and answer session we can discuss it at greater length, a trend which I think is very disturbing, which is that it appears to me that there is some effort by the Defense Department to move into domestic counterterrorism and domestic intelligence activities. One example of that, of course, is the NSA surveillance, which is now directed towards Americans much more than it was in the past. There are other examples, including something called the Counterintelligence Field Activity, which has evidently taken upon itself the task of domestic collection in a much broader way than the Defense Department has done in the past. We've seen reports already of the DOD counterintelligence field activity, collecting more than 100 reports and storing them in their computers on anti-war protesters. And when the Congress and Senator Leahy raised questions about that, they said that was a mistake and they agreed to destroy those reports. But that wasn't the first time in the last couple of years that that's happened. Previously, a different part of the Defense Department had sent undercover people to a conference on Islamic law at a law school in Texas. And what you have, I think, is the tendency, which is almost unstoppable and which is actually discussed. If it's interesting, if you go to the DOD website and to their to the Assistant Secretary for Intelligence Oversight, there's a small history of how the Defense Department in the 70s got involved in spying on anti-war protesters and started off with some legitimate mission having to do with protecting its forces. And according to the DOD's own analysis, it was a case of mission creep, and they ended up collecting thousands of files on American protesters against the Vietnam War. Now, in this day and age when we have much greater computer capability, a very strong inclination by the government to use that capability both to store information and then to analyze that information in the hopes of finding the individuals, I think that we face two risks. One is that the government, as it has been prone to in the past, will not be careful to distinguish between those who are planning terrorist attacks and those who may either share the religion of the terrorists or some of the political views of the terrorists. And the effect of that will be not only that the civil liberties of Americans will be threatened, but that, as has happened in the past, they will focus on the wrong people and in doing so miss the next 19 hijackers.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you. I also want to thank American University Law School, Washington School of Law, I guess, and Josh in particular for inviting me to today, and my colleagues here, in particular Harvey. I want to talk a little bit about, I want to make three points. First of all, I want to find out if anybody here is an FBI special agent, lawyer, analyst, other. Would anyone? No, it's not. All right, whatever, I'm sure there are. The first thing I want to talk about is how, and I think the title of our panel is an example of this, how the issue of MI5 has been bound up in the issue for us of whether we want to separate domestic collection of foreign intelligence from domestic law enforcement. We're not setting up a domestic intelligence agency to collect about domestic things. The point here is to collect foreign intelligence inside the United States. So an agency that, if we were to set up a new agency, it wouldn't go after Tim McVeigh or motorcycle gangs or militias. It would be going after foreign threats to our country. So that's first, my first point. The second point is that MI5, although it provides interesting source of successes and failures, I'm sure there are some failures, for us to draw upon if we were to go forward and create our own separate intelligence, foreign intelligence agency collecting domestically. But it will never, if we do so, look very much like MI5. There are fundamental differences, as Keith mentioned, between our two countries that would never allow us to have an entity quite like that. The only real similarity we would have, I believe, would be that it's separated from law enforcement. Beyond that, we can create, if we were to do so, anything we want. It can look like whatever we decide it to look like. The reasons that it will have to be very different from MI5 are pretty obvious. One is that's a very little country and we're a very big country. Another is we have a constitution and they don't. And a third is that we have state and local law enforcement entities to deal with, and they don't have quite that kind of problem. In terms of the constitutional issues, there are many. And when I talk about civil liberties in a minute, I'll discuss that a bit. But the main one that exists is the fact that because of our constitution, in the intelligence business, we make a fine distinction between U.S. citizens and green card holders, otherwise known as U.S. persons, and everybody else. And there are really four kinds of people you can be in this world. You can be an American citizen in the United States. You can be a foreign citizen in the United States. You can be an American citizen in some other country. And you can be a foreign person in some other country. And the way we target those different kinds of people are very, very different depending on what class you fall into. If you're a foreign person in a foreign country, pretty much all bets are off. You can do pretty much anything to them. We used to say anything but torture and kill them, but apparently that's changing as well. But United States citizens and permanent resident aliens inside the United States hold special protections both in the law enforcement arena and in the current intelligence arena. And there's no reason to think that a new agency, if it were created, would put those kinds of protections in jeopardy. In fact, because they're constitutionally based in some cases, they wouldn't be able to. And remember, once again, we're collecting foreign intelligence. So U.S. citizens doing U.S. things would really be outside the mission of such a new agency. Senator Edwards, who I staffed when I was on the Senate Intelligence Committee in addition to my legal responsibilities, is, I think, the only member of Congress who's actually drafted and filed a bill to create a true domestic intelligence agency. And he did it at the beginning of 2003, much to the chagrin of Director Mueller, who became quite red-faced in a public hearing and challenged Senator Edwards to come to the FBI and hear all about the reforms that they had made post 9/11. So Senator begged him not to file his bill until he had done that. Well, Senator Edwards filed his bill the next day, and then a month or so later did go down and get a 3 or 4 hour presentation. I was with him, from Director Mueller and others, about all the reforms, was not at that time persuaded that any of his concerns that caused him to create a new intelligence try to create a new intelligence agency were addressed. And many of them are cultural, and I'll talk about that in a bit, that Keith mentioned. But they're also institutional. They're very different types of functions and different types of agencies. On the civil liberties point, and I think Senator Edwards was very, very concerned about that when he drafted the bill and took it into account, I think Kate did an excellent job of presenting, the best I've heard in her paper, which I highly recommend, and in her presentation, of explaining the best argument you can make against this from a civil liberties point of view. While I agree with that her arguments are good ones to support that point of view, I disagree with all of her arguments and, in fact, believe that the arguments she makes, in fact, support the need for a separate entity. Civil liberties groups, bless their hearts, because being a national security civil liberties lawyer is very, very difficult for a lot of reasons. Number one, it's the intelligence and counterterrorism business have to be scary, aggressive efforts. And to be a civil liberties lawyer and have credibility, you have to acknowledge that they have to do stuff that, you know, gets close to the line, but still try to keep them on the right side of the line. But I think that what they do as a result is they fall back on, and Kate has done this in her piece, they fall back on the criminal model. They believe that I'm comfortable with the criminal protections we have. They're constitutionally based. We've had them for many, many years. They work. They're not perfect, but I like it. I feel it's familiar. It's comfortable to me. And so they cling to the concept that law enforcement and intelligence have to be linked because the people who do the job have to be the same people and have to be knowledgeable and well-versed and bound by the kinds of civil liberties protections that exist in our criminal field. I think that that's basically taking a system of civil liberties protection that works over here, picking it up and putting it over here on top of a function that is completely different. I think that what you need to do instead is to take the civil liberties goals that you're trying to reach by your set of rules and create new ones that fit your new agency. There's absolutely no reason why a new foreign intelligence agency that collects domestically, I'm going to keep saying that to try to get that across because I do think there's a lot of confusion there. There's absolutely no reason why we couldn't have a very rigorous civil liberties set of rules and oversight, et cetera. In fact, in Senator Edwards' bill, he did at least two things that would have made us, our civil liberties in the intelligence area, better. His whole goal was to be better at counterterrorism and security and better at civil liberties. There's no reason it has to be either or. One of them was he set up a, I can't remember what it was called, but it was some kind of a civil liberties review panel that would be required to do constant sort of oversight of the both the rules and the implementation of the rules by this new agency. And secondly, in one particular area, he brought within FISA, within the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act requirements, what Kate referred to, which is the ability of the FBI to go into religious organizations, mosques or churches or anything, and if they're available to the public, they can go in and observe and report back and write up reports and never acknowledge that they work for the Bureau. We would have required in our bill a FISA judge to say that that's okay, that you have to would have to actually make a showing that there was a reason to go into the Methodist church on the corner and go to there and bring a lasagna and show up and participate in the effort. And that doesn't exist today. One more thing on civil liberties. Intelligence collection is non-coercive. One of the reasons you need certain types of restrictions on law enforcement is you are going to arrest people and put them in jail. I would submit that one of the problems and why the FBI is, in my opinion, ineffective as a domestic intelligence agency, and remember, we have a domestic intelligence agency. It's not like whether we're going to have one. We have one. It's just, in my view, not doing a particularly good job. Because they always do look to the end game. They always do look to a prosecution. They cannot help themselves. They are they are recruited to be FBI special agents. They are trained. They are rewarded. All of these things aim toward prosecutions. And there's absolutely no way that someone who is who has a mindset of catching bad guys, who chooses the FBI for that reason, and is trained to do that, is ever going to be able to step back and say, you know what, intelligence isn't evidence. It's just information. In fact, it's more than information. You've got three things. You've got information out there, you've got intelligence out there, and you've got evidence out there. Information is just stuff. Intelligence is stuff that you collect that meets an intelligence requirement that has been preset by the United States of America by the requirements process. And the FBI, in its intelligence collection, to the extent that it has done that, never had to follow that process. FISA is a perfect example. They could run all over the country and say, I want to do a FISA, I got a guy. Well, intelligence collection isn't driven by, I got a guy, I want to go up on his wire. It's driven by collecting information that meets a preset requirement. Intelligence resources are limited. You've got to make sure that what you're collecting meets a requirement that the United States policymakers need. And FISA, although it's a massive intelligence collection tool, never had to do that. Title IX of the USA Patriot Act forced them to do that. I don't know if they're actually doing it, but that it says they have to, so I hope they are. It said that has to be part of the requirements process, and if a particular FBI field office has enough money to do 10 FISAs, well, they have to make sure that they are 10 FISAs that meet the overall requirements of the United States. And in most cases nowadays, it would be terrorism. So I think that I've talked about recruitment training, the difference between information, intelligence, and evidence. Evidence, by the way, proves something. You start a law enforcement investigation and you move linearly to an end. You see a bad guy, maybe a terrorist, maybe he's doing other kinds of things, and you follow the line and you don't go too far afield. An intelligence investigation is exactly the opposite. You go all over the place. The dots are everywhere. They don't follow a line with an end game. It never ends. And Kate finds that unfortunate, but in fact, that's how intelligence works. There isn't an end. You're not trying to prove anything. You're trying to collect intelligence that will then be used by analysts with all the other intelligence they have, SIGINT, overseas intelligence, et cetera, so that you can conclude things. Not prove things, but learn things that will help you protect the country. I think that's about it. One word on the wall, and then we'll go to questions. One of the things that always bothered me about the wall, first of all, as we now know, there really wasn't one, but people have sort of created it out of their desire not to share, and in fact, there really wasn't one, and now to the extent that it had existed, it's being dismantled, and I think that's working pretty well. One way the FBI has improved tremendously is in its sharing of information. But the real wall that nobody seemed that worried about is, in fact, the wall that was the most bothersome of all. It wasn't the wall between the intelligence entities of the FBI not giving what it should to the criminal elements of the FBI. It was the intelligence elements of the FBI not giving anything to the intelligence entities of the rest of the government. That wasn't a wall. They just didn't do it. They didn't even share FISA. This big, huge, fat intelligence, foreign intelligence collection apparatus didn't even give it to the CIA. They do now. So anyway, I've rambled on long enough, and thank you.
Thank you.
First of all, let me thank the panelists for staying so tightly to the times. And second of all, I forgot to introduce Vicki's background, which is University of Virginia Law School in Holyoke. And I say that because my wife is a graduate of Holyoke, and she'd be very upset if I didn't mention that. I see we have the people lining up. I'm going to do something a little bit different. Some of the panelists would like to have I'll give them 1 minute rebuttals so that they can respond quickly to Vicki's analysis. Kate.
Two quick points. The definition of what it means to collect foreign intelligence in the United States means to collect information about Americans engaged in all kinds of activities in some connection with foreigners. I'll give you two examples. Undercover infiltration of mosques in order to determine whether or not there's some terrorism being talked about counts as foreign intelligence, even when everyone attending that mosque is an American Muslim. And the other example is undercover infiltration of the AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, in order to determine whether or not there's some clandestine relationship with Israel counts as foreign intelligence. And the other 20-second point I want to make is that I think it's not a question of intelligence never ending. I think the question is, what is the end? And the end, which is to protect our country, requires some specific analysis of what does that mean. I think what it means at the moment is to find any individuals who may be either seeking to come here or who are here who are planning or conspiring to carry out an attack. And that's an end. It doesn't mean you don't have a continuing investigation.
Thank you, Kate. Keith, would you like to correct the record on the MI5?
It's the comment about the FBI not being able to collect intelligence as intelligence officers and that they are cops and they will always be cops. The point I made in my presentation that there is a difference between an intelligence officer and a law enforcement officer. And my experience of working with the FBI is that they do understand this difference and they do understand that prosecution is only one outcome of many outcomes that particularly in intelligence cases that there could be. The outcome of the of an intelligence case could actually be the recruitment of the individual, not necessarily the prosecution of that individual. And I don't see any conflict at all in the FBI and their understanding of these different outcomes.
Great, thank you. Let's open it to the floor. Kelly, why don't you begin, Anna?
Y'all mentioned, and I think it was Ms. Martin who was talking about the intelligence collection and the intelligence agencies and the wall. Everybody mentioned the wall between intelligence and law enforcement and things like that. And I'm just curious, because of, you know, people say that you can't, the CIA is not trained in collecting intelligence that can be used in court and stuff like that. And yet you have, you know, the amendment to the National Security Act was done in 1996 that said the intelligence community can be tasked to collect intelligence on non-Americans abroad for law enforcement purposes. And then you have MI5 that, as far as I understand, the MI5 officers are trained, you know, hand in hand to collect intelligence in such a way that it can be used in criminal prosecutions when they hand it over to the law enforcement apparatus. And so I'm wondering, you know, with these cooperations that are in place already, why is there such a rift as y'all seem to indicate there is?
Okay.
Well, I think that there has been a lot of work, and it started way before 9/11. There's a report that was done in 1996 about how information collected by intelligence agencies could be used in criminal prosecutions, and a lot of interagency work. I think it's cultural, you know, is that when it comes down to it, if you ask the CIA, look, we can prosecute this person, but it means outing the source. It means that the source can't be used again because we're going to have to identify the source, and maybe they'll be subject to cross-examination or not. But in any event, this is the end. And that the CIA traditionally has had a culture of, no, we want that source in place forever. And the FBI has a culture of, no, it's time to bring the source in and prosecute. We actually have bureaucratic measures. You know, the Attorney General is in part, and the National Security Council are supposed to make the ultimate decisions about whether or not in this particular instance it makes sense to prosecute or to leave the source there. And, you know, and it's an issue that they've had in espionage cases forever. It's not a new issue.
I just want to say, I mean, I would partially agree and partially disagree with what Kate said. The issue in when you pursue a prosecution that intelligence agencies have been involved in up to the point, it rarely involves whether a source would testify, because they would never allow that, I don't think, under almost no circumstances, unless it's against bin Laden, I suppose. But what happened before 9/11, and I was working at the agency at that time, was that the operations officers, with their help of their lawyers, tried very hard to work closely with law enforcement for the very reason you're talking about, to make sure that what they did parallel with what law enforcement was doing would not compromise a potential future case. And as a result, there was a lot of coordination to make sure that, for example, if someone grabbed a pocket litter from some terrorist in some operation, that it would never be in the hands of either a CIA officer or a CIA asset, because you wouldn't want them in the chain of custody. And so we bent over backwards to try to keep that from happening, to preserve the possibility of a prosecution. Frankly, looking back on it, I regret that, because I think that what we did then is the prosecution reigned supreme, and everything else had to contort itself to fit that end game, when in fact prosecutions are one tool and a diminishing one, frankly. I mean, we're learning that you have to fight this so-called war. In many ways, law enforcement is a smaller part of our effort, not a bigger one.
Keith, how has MI5 dealt with the problem of the criminal side of the house and the intelligent equity side of the house? What's the process, from your experience, how they resolve that riddle?
The first point is that everyone has to understand what the purpose of the wall is. It's not there as a barrier to preventing people from doing things. It's there to protect sensitive sources and sensitive techniques. If you lose the source or you lose the technique, then you've lost it. And the bad guys are always trying to find out what the how did the good guys know that they were onto them? When did they find out? Who is the source? Is it a bug? Is it a human source? And how can we deal with that? And that's crucial. There have been mistakes. There have been problems associated with the security service engaging much more in, particularly in counterterrorism, in counter-espionage, counter-subversion. There were very few criminal cases because subversion and espionage do not reach the courts unless it is an internal spy. And there's been some here, and there's been some in the UK. But in the main, espionage was against foreign spies. They were against people acting under some form of cover, whether it be diplomatic cover or businessman cover. And once they were identified, they were then very quietly made persona non grata, and they went back. And this was the long game, because as soon as you make something public, then the other side retaliates. And so this is how the security service used to work. There's an issue that they had to learn about the chain of evidence, that if they could not prove the chain of evidence that was would meet the requirements of the court, then we would lose cases. So if there had been a break in the chain of evidence, so we had to do a lot of training, particularly with security service surveillance officers, about their notes and the fact of them being prepared to stand up and give evidence in court. They were very concerned because, again, you're identifying a security service surveillance officer, a very valuable resource. So we had to look at having screens in courts to actually preserve the anonymity of the operators. Fruits of the poison tree. The security service are not bound by the same rules that a law enforcement organization is bound by. So they could engage in activity that would be seen to be outside of the rules of evidence. And once they've done that, once they have potentially acted as an agent provocateur, which is quite legitimate within an intelligence operation because you're gathering more information if you provide something with something, but what you can't do is then try and prosecute once you've acted as the agent provocateur. If you've given the individual the means to carry out the attack and the fact that they're interested in it, which is different here. What I see here is you have these sting operations where individuals are actually provided very much more with material that would not be allowed within the UK. So you have this checks and balances. The point on sources, we have had human sources testify in courts. There's been a number of high-profile ones, and one of them, in the not too distant past, was in fact an FBI source who brought down key figures within the IRA. So it does happen, and it's very interesting that you actually see this in one jurisdiction where a law enforcement intelligence agency will allow their source to actually give evidence in another jurisdiction. So it has happened.
Great. Let's open up to the floor, sir.
I'm Gary Thomas. I'm the security correspondent for Voice of America. Question and a comment. First of all, in Britain you have this multiplicity of agencies, the anti-terrorist branch, MI5, special branch. What kind of jurisdictional and bureaucratic overlap problems result out of having a multiplicity of agencies perhaps stepping on each other's toes? Who resolves those disputes? And second of all, Kate, on the question of military intelligence, this is something I've been looking at for some years, that Army intelligence was actually well established in the 1950s and 60s with MI groups that paralleled the FBI system in the United States. And it's only after the scandals of the 1970s that they were disbanded. But I'm wondering if this counterintelligence field activity is a means of resurrecting this.
Okay, on the first point about the deconfliction, if you like, the anti-terrorist branch and Metropolitan Police Special Branch, who do have a national function of dealing with counter-terrorism in the UK, were invited in by the chief officer of wherever the incident is taking place or has occurred, and it's a rebuttable presumption. That means that the line is that if there is a terrorist event taking place, or there's intelligence about a terrorist event about to take place anywhere in Great Britain, then the anti-terrorist branch will be involved in that investigation, unless the chief constable actually says, I don't want you to come in, which is he has then, or she has got to explain why they will not invite the specialist in. Both the anti-terrorist branch and special branch work to the same senior officer, the Assistant Commissioner of Specialist Operations at New Scotland Yard, who is also currently the chairman of the Association of Chief Police Officers Terrorism Allied Matters Committee. So he sits at a policy level, and he also has operational command of the troops on the ground. And for any intelligence investigation that looks as if it's turning into an evidential investigation, there is a National Coordinator of Terrorist Investigations who is the Deputy Assistant Commissioner, who is the head of the anti-terrorist branch. And what happens is that there is an arrangement where the security service, at an early stage of an investigation, if they think it's looking as if this is going to be a terrorist incident where it was needed to be executive action, they will consult with the national coordinator and work under his guidance to a stage where he then takes over the operation and runs it as an executive operation. And the last point is that in relatively recent times, the relationship, this is particularly post 9/11, the relationship between the anti-terrorist branch as the detectives and the security service has grown incredibly close and incredibly strong, to the event that most of the senior officers in the anti-terrorist branch actually have passes to get into the security service building and can go and meet their colleagues in the security service, not necessarily to talk about specific cases, but to talk about issues in general. And this is a relationship which is to be lauded as an example of the best type of activity, where you get this close working relationship of the two agencies coming together, and they actually create an understanding and a friendship in dealing with the threat that we're dealing with.
Thank you. Sir.
First, a comment, Mr. Weston. I really appreciate your statement that, you know, the object is to try to improve our processes, to try to preempt and prosecute where we can. And given that, we can still end up in the situation where we do everything and still a bad result follows. The one thing that I think has been missing from the debate, and from the standpoint here as lawyers, place our civil liberties at a very, very high premium. The one, I guess, position or choice that we make as a society, no one ever wants to see a repeat of September the 11th and the death of 3,000 people. But I think the American people need to be made aware that our constitutional freedoms are as important, that if, in order to protect the freedoms of one or two who may be suspect, who may have bad intent, but where the burden or the hurdle has not been overcome, that we as a society have got to be willing to accept potential loss of life to protect our sacred freedoms. And following that comment, the statement Ms. Martin had made was that once we end up in a domestic scenario, that the model is such that forced to use a law enforcement mechanism. Does that imply that for some reason we ended up in a situation where we had a group, a very dedicated group, who was within domestic territory, who was at the imminent point of creating or causing a massive loss of life, a massive damage to the United States position that the president would not have the authority to act outside of a law enforcement model, but to employ a military model within the domestic United States and to treat those individuals as military targets?
Let's focus on the group, on the privacy issue first. Have the Brits moved the line on privacy so much more dramatically than we feel it as Americans? You can't go to London now without being photographed, I think, about 300 times if you go into the major tourist areas. The Brits are comfortable with that. Are the two Americans comfortable with that?
I guess I my general response to your the question is that posing the trade-off in those generalities doesn't advance the discussion or the analysis. That the question about how much information should the government collect on how many individuals has to be answered with regard to, and what kind of effective use can it make of it, and what are going to be the protections against abuse of it. That, you know, you can say, well, are we willing to sacrifice the liberties of one or two people in order to prevent the next 3,000 being killed? And the answer seems obviously yes. But the question I would put back to you is, what exactly is that hypothetical? Because
my question is not a hypothetical. It's that we as a group of people in a political body, I'm willing to accept that potential loss of life to protect constitutional freedoms. And I don't always believe that you're dealing with a zero-sum situation.
Your argument is clear. He's part of the position that says, I'm willing to sacrifice life in order to protect certain fundamental views of our sense of privacy. That's a position in the debate. And you're saying that doesn't really advance the debate from your perspective.
No, I think it doesn't begin to grapple with the difficult choices that we face. I think that if you go to your second hypothetical about the president knowing there are a band of individuals who are about to engage in attack, can he use a military option? I'm not sure what that means. Can he send, instead of sending the FBI special forces, can he send the DOD special forces because they're closer and have them shoot the guys without trying to arrest them? No. But does he need to do that? No. The deal is that if the people are engaged in it and resisting arrest, the law enforcement agents can use force to make sure that they're arrested. And once they're arrested, I mean, and I'm not sure what...
I would diverge from you.
I think, just factually, we have NEST teams. And a classic example is a nuclear emergency strategic team. The FBI usually is not particularly trained in those issues. When the nature of the threat is such, clearly the president has the power to deploy the NEST team. So that's sort of, I think that's settled sort of customary law inside our state. Let me move on to the next question, though. Okay.
My name is Charlie Martel. I'm an adjunct professor here, and I wanted to thank the panel for a very informative presentation. I studied for a master's in London last year, and I was aware of the security cameras. I'm not sure if I behaved any better, but I did make sure I cleaned up after my dog and I dressed nicer. So it's a positive impact.
I see that hasn't carried over when you came back to the States.
We need to be both less dogs and more cameras. But to get to my question, I guess my concern is a little bit more logistical. And it's informed a little bit by our experience with the Homeland Security Department. It takes a lot of time to staff up a new department, to create new institutional and individual relationships for it to be effective. And I think we saw with Hurricane Katrina how hard that can be to do and what the costs of that can be. So I guess my question is initially addressed to Mr. Weston. How hard was that to do in the UK, create these new domestic agencies, for them to staff the agencies and develop the relationships they need to have to be effective? And then for the panel as a whole, how should those sort of considerations inform our decision about whether to do the same thing here? Thanks.
They weren't just created. As I said, the initial setting up of MI5 and MI6 went right back to pre-First World War to a very small group, a Secret Service Bureau, which then split into what the organisations, massive organisations, they are today. The Special Branch was formed in 1883 and grew across all of the 52 police forces in the United Kingdom. And the anti-terrorist branch was formed because there was an acceptance that the current mechanisms of dealing with these bombs that were going off were that the current systems weren't effective. So they had to create a new group. And that was the anti-terrorist branch. And that goes right back to 1972. So we actually did nothing after 9/11. We've actually, what we are looking at doing at the moment is to actually bring the anti-terrorist branch and Metropolitan Police Special Branch a bit closer together by actually having a counter-terrorist command. And that all that is a functional thing. It will not mean any difference to the boys and girls who are actually doing the job. They won't see any difference at all. So we have, and this is why we're talking about the evolution process, that you can't just open another box and say, right, we're going to have this new system, because that is so difficult to manage when you're in the middle of a war.
Vicky.
I think it's a good question, and I think it, after 9/11, it was one of the reasons, the difficulty with which the government, the problems the government has creating a new entity or something vastly different, plagued them then. And as a result, what you've seen is that we acted in the short term and we created more layers of bureaucracy. I think many thought those would be helpful, but in fact, the DNI's office now has 800 employees and is doing many things and not doing many of the things many of us hoped they would be doing. So I think creating layers of bureaucracy, although easier and quicker, is short-sighted. And in fact, you just got to bite the bullet. And if you need completely new institutions, you got to do it. And I think we were acting on, oh my God, we're going to be attacked any minute. We got to, you know, staff up and get things running. I think we now realize we're in this for the long haul, and the way MI5 and Special Branch evolved over time, you just have to bite the bullet and do it, and if you believe that it needs to be done.
Great, thank you. Do you have a last comment?
Well, I just want to say, you know, creating new institutions is a favorite thing of the politicians to do since 9/11, but, you know, you have the same people. You have a limited number of potential FBI special agents, analysts, et cetera, and you have a lot of specific non-glamorous problems which the government needs to concentrate on. The computer systems working, how they're going to share classified information. And those problems get neglected when the political discourse is about, should we reorganize from the top down, et cetera. And I think that it makes sense to take the existing institutions and make them work better, just from a bureaucratic point of view.
As you know, there's the old joke. Yeah, there's the old joke in Washington. When you take over an agency, your predecessor usually says there's three envelopes in the safe. He says after your first crisis, open up the first envelope. And envelope number one says blame me for everything, and then after the second crisis, the second envelope says reorganize. And then the third envelope after the third crisis is write three envelopes. As always in these forums, we will have the Marines get the last question.
Given the FBI's history of infiltrating non-Christian groups, KKK, or other churches, things like this, pursuing civil rights, radical right-wing, anti-abortion groups, why do you think that Muslims and mosques
Well, I didn't say that. What I was pointing out was that when Vicky mentioned we're only talking about foreign intelligence, that what foreign intelligence means is the infiltration of groups of Americans engaged in all kinds of political activities. And it doesn't include the KKK and the anti-abortion groups, but it does include American Muslims. It includes people active pro-Israeli politics, for example. And our position has never been that there should be no surveillance of groups engaged in First Amendment-protected religious or political activities. Because it is clear that sometimes people engage in terrorism with an agenda that's based on either religious ideology or political ideology. We have worked for 20 years to try to come up with a system both that has rules about when it makes sense to infiltrate, what protections can you build into the system so that there are not abuses, and what do you do with the information that's obtained from that? So I wasn't making that point. But I do think it's illustrative of the one of the fundamental problems here, which is that an intelligence agency, I think, is all too ready to say, you know what, if we could know what's happening in every mosque in the United States, wouldn't we prefer that? And that since we live in a country that has a First Amendment and it is important to us, that what we need is an approach that says, what is our purpose in infiltrating the mosque? We need to be clear about the purpose and about what we're going to use the information for. And the purpose, obviously, should be limited to finding or identifying individuals who are planning the next attack. And that's a very difficult and specific problem that's not answered by talking about generalities or moving bureaucratic boxes.
Last point, Keith.
It's just to clarify, the current threat we're dealing with is not an issue about religion. We're not, this is not about Islam, it's not about Muslims and Christians, this is not a religious conflict. I have an issue about, and I'm sure it's not intended, about making this into, you know, to find out what's going on, we've got to spy on mosques and look at Muslims, and an American Muslim is actually a foreigner and all this sort of thing. The crucial thing is that this is about a perverted ideology, and as soon as that we start making this into a religious issue, then we are falling into Bin Laden's trap, and that's what he wants us to do. And as soon as we start talking about different parts of the community and seeing them as different because of the religion that they have to practice, and labeling them as potentially as possible people that we need to put under surveillance, we're creating big problems for ourselves. There is an issue that within the UK that we work with the communities, that counter-terrorism is something you do with communities, not against communities. So we do not look at spying on mosques. And it's just something which I have a strong feeling about, and it's something which you know, I need to get over on this panel.
I would never deny an uncommon woman the last comment.
I just want to clarify one point. The notion that collecting foreign intelligence in the United States means you're spying on Americans is a little of an exaggeration. Yes, you might be spying on Americans, but you're only interested in the Americans' activities to the extent they are collaborating and in touch with foreign groups and foreign countries. It's foreign intelligence. We care about foreign threats to our country, not domestic threats to our country. And it's not just about terrorism. It's about any type of intelligence information. You could have an Iranian-American in Detroit who knows is in contact with Iran on WMD issues. There are many, many issues in addition to terrorism that we need to collect. The world is a big place, and you can't have collection of foreign intelligence everywhere and then this sort of limited special collection in the United States, or it's a safe haven for terrorists and other types of people who want to harm the United States. So, yes, Americans can be targeted for foreign intelligence under certain protections, but they're not the sole target.
Thank you. I very much want to thank the panel. I think what the discussion has highlighted is that regardless of the institutional structure, the fundamental questions of where do we draw the line on privacy? How do we understand the notion of our own First Amendment? And what Judge Weathercup mentioned in the panel before us, what is the actual domestic context that we feel comfortable with as the state intervenes more dramatically and gathers information? And we all agree it has to be done. And Kate's point is, well, for what point and what is the checks and balances on that issue? And MI5 has one version of checks and balances. And Vicky represents the notion that we have to take very seriously the idea that we have to secure the home life. And balancing those problems is just not easy, regardless of what your institutional framework is. With that, I also want to put out another hat. If you want to look at more information about the Patriot and the Wall, I recommend the American Bar Association's National Security Law publication, The Patriotic Debates, The Patriot Debates, which you can get online, which also kind of continues this conversation in a sort of legal, scholarly, dispassionate way. So administratively, we're going to have lunch after this particular panel. It is directly behind us, behind that wall, in the cafeteria. So I invite you all to join us who are part of the conference. We will reconvene at 1:15 for the next panel. I see Kelly's motioning to me. It's on the other side of the cafeteria. And can I have a round of applause for that wonderful panel?